Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to spend the rest of the hour with a singular voice on public radio. He's also one of my favorites, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Jack is the author of a number of books. His latest is The Lost History of 1914, How the Great War Was Not Inevitable. But Jack's newest work is something different. It's a play called The Battle Not Begun, Munich, 1938, and it will be performed this Saturday at Black Box Lab at the Community House in Hamilton. And Jack joins us now. Jack Beatty, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you, Meghna, for your generosity. I'm just delighted to be with you.
It's great to have you, and I'm glad that Tom Ashbrook and the On Point crew let us borrow you for a little bit today. Well, let me just first start by asking you, I mean, your last book was 1914, about the dawn of the Great War. Was 1938 a natural next place for you in terms of historical exploration?
Well, yes, in that really 19, A.J.P. Taylor, the British historian, said that if in history you can say that one event caused another, as you can say in physics, for example, that one thing caused another, you can say that World War I caused World War II. And therefore, it's my interest in 1938 and in how the Second World War began is of a piece with the curiosity that led me to 1914.
Yeah. And I mean, specifically the Munich Agreement, because it is such an iconic moment, right? What was it about Munich and the aftermath of that that made you think, this is where I want to focus right now?
Well, I've sort of grown up haunted by Munich. It has been cited as a cautionary tale by interventionists and hawks in every American conflict and even crisis since 1945. It is the regnant metaphor in foreign policy. There are very few. This one is. And basically this says, if you don't stop aggression in one place, it'll go someplace else. It'll get even worse down the line. Here is Lyndon Johnson, for example, saying, "Everything I knew about history told me that if I got out of Vietnam and let Ho Chi Minh run through the streets of Saigon, I'd be doing what Chamberlain did in World War II. I would be seen as a coward and my nation as an appeaser." The variants of that argument have justified American wars ever since, and even before Korea. So I, as one opposed to almost all of those interventions, I have reckoned with Munich on and off, and I proposed writing a book about the metaphor and really looking at it, but then it had been done and done very well by others, but then I got interested in the conference itself, and I wondered was Munich a Munich? That is, was Munich as bad as everybody says? The British had the strong hand, that they should have stood up to Hitler. They failed to do so. He was encouraged next year to invade Poland, and the Second World War ensued. Is there truth to that? And what I discovered when I went back and looked at the cabinet meetings, looked at the books, the biographies, and so on, is increasingly scholars say no, there isn't truth to that. Chamberlain had a very limited hand. He dealt the best hand he could, and he put off war for a year. Now, some people say that was a disaster because in the meantime, Soviet Russia, which had been part of the coalition in 1938, yeah. signed a pact, non-aggression pact with Hitler. But on the other hand, if you're a Chamberlain and the Joint Chiefs of Staff there say war now would be suicide, Prime Minister, you're not going to go to war over a few German-speaking people in Czechoslovakia.
Well, Jack. So I want to come back to Neville Chamberlain here in a second. But just for people who don't remember this moment in history, so the Munich talks were between Adolf Hitler and Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Great Britain, and the discussion was about the fate of Czechoslovakia, right?
Yes, Yes, Czechoslovakia had, it was cobbled together in 1918, 1919, out of the shards of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And you had Slovaks, you had Czechs, you had Ruthenes, you had Poles, you had Hungarians, and you had up along the German border and around the Austrian border, a German-speaking Sudeten, that is South German speakers. And the Sudeten Germans, 3 million out of a population of 9 million, so they were a substantial part of the Czech population, Hitler funded a Nazi party there. It agitated for autonomy within the Czechoslovak state. The Czechoslovak state, Prague, said, sure, you can have the autonomy. And then Hitler provoked violence there. This is all in the summer of 1938. And instead of autonomy within Czechoslovakia, the new goal was annexation by Germany, the Sudeten Germans to go home. As Chamberlain's cab driver put it to him, we can't very well go to war, sir, to stop Germans returning to Germany now, can we? Huh. And you know, that was a pretty powerful argument. They seemed to want to return to Germany. And Chamberlain's view was, well, my gosh, this Czechoslovakia, this was put together, this is a Woodrow Wilson project, a kind of triumph of idealism over geography and history. And he wholly sympathized with German complaints against the Versailles Treaty. So he was more than willing to say, yes, you can have the Sudeten Germans if that's what you want, and to silence Prague, to say, basically, if you don't go for this, you're on your own. You have to fight Germany on your own.
And yet a year later, Europe was at war. I mean, so you've turned this into a play, right? You've turned these talks that happened between Hitler and Chamberlain into a play based on history, but of course fictionalized because it's for the stage. So, I mean, I want to talk with you a little bit more about how you render Neville Chamberlain, because honestly, he's a rather infamous figure in history now, as you said a little earlier. So I want to play a bit of archival tape from the moment which I think Chamberlain goes down in history as. It's that infamous moment where he is landed back in Great Britain and he's waving that piece of paper.
We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
But of course, how wrong he was. I mean, Jack, here's a man who is almost literally, in our historical memory now, defined by that one word you used earlier, appeasement.
Yes.
So how is it that you got into his head? I mean, how did you put him onto the stage? What Neville Chamberlain did you find on stage?
Well, I try to answer this question, why did he want peace? And the other question I wanted to answer was, why did Hitler want war? And the answers aren't obvious in either case. And my Chamberlain, and I think to a certain extent, to a large extent, the Chamberlain of history, wanted peace because he saw modern warfare, as uniquely destructive, and to him, destructive of the beauties, the tenuous pastoral idol of England. And I have him in a speech to the House of Commons basically say, here is what is at stake. And he talks about the beauties of an English sunset, the smell of hay in the fields, the chiming of church bells. And he had this view that this is all to be destroyed by the German Air Force if we have a war. And it nothing could be worth seeing that destroyed. And he had a vastly overestimated view of what the Germans could do in the air. His chiefs said to him, there'll be 600,000 dead within 6 months. Well, in the whole 6 years, there were only 60,000 British civilians killed. So the chiefs were off by a factor of 10. Huh. But that's what was in his mind.
Well, but Jack, I wonder if I just can jump in here for a second, because Chamberlain actually died not long after the Munich Agreement, right? He died in 1940.
Yes.
And just weeks before he died, we found this quote that he had written, that Chamberlain wrote, on the whole, although I have a sense I have, in a sense, failed in everything I set out to achieve. I do not believe that history will blame me for that. And I don't regard my public life as a failure.
Yes.
I mean, after having written this play, do you regard his public life as a failure or not?
I do not. He was right to make his deal with Hitler. He was wrong and a fool to think that this slip of paper he had Hitler sign, which was apart from the Munich Agreement on Czechoslovakia, the slip of paper that just said, "Oh, we're going to love each other forever, you Britain," and he thought that was the trophy of Munich, and it was meaningless, of course. So he was a fool for peace. But, you know, I'm just reading A.J.P. Taylor. He says basically the weapons that were got Britain through the war, and certainly the Battle of Britain, Hurricanes and Spitfire planes, that was under Chamberlain. That buildup was both as Chancellor of the Exchequer and as Prime Minister. He played the card. I don't see him as an utter failure, and neither do historians today, I think.
Well, Jack, so we should talk about, of course, the other man, Adolf Hitler. You wrote he's a major part of the play as well. What was it like getting into Hitler's head and creating a Hitler for the stage?
Well, it was a frightening experience. You're afraid of being infected by him. And yet at the same time, you've got to create a character. You've got to have imaginative sympathy. That is, you've got to get inside and make him explicable to the audience. And what I try to show is why it was he wanted a war. And in this long monologue he has with Mussolini, he ties in his experience in 1914 and the First World War to essentially what he wanted in 1938. And it comes out that the only time in his life he felt significant, he felt valued, he felt at home in the world were those 4 wretched years, we would think, in the trenches.
Wow.
But somehow the war, the destruction, corresponded to something inside him, and he could feel at home there, and he wanted that for the whole world.
Jack, let me ask you, we've got just a couple seconds here left to go. You've written this play about 1938, but you're putting it on before a 2016 audience, right?
Yes.
In the throes of an election that makes me have to take a deep breath every now and then. I mean, your thoughts about today's audience seeing this?
Well, you know, you can't help but, you know, pick up the newspaper and people make comparison. They call Donald Trump a fascist. I don't think that's true, but there's much about him that's very disturbing in terms of his rejection of democratic norms. Hitler had no use for democracy. And I'm not sure that Donald Trump has a great deal of value for it. After all, he wanted to jail his opponent if he wins.
Well, that's On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. His latest work is a play called The Battle Not Begun, Munich, 1938. There will be a staged reading of it this Saturday at 7:30 at Black Box Lab at the Community House in Hamilton. We've got more information at our website, RadioBoston.org. Jack, congratulations on the new play, and it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna. I really appreciate it.
That's it for today. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.